This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Iliad by Homer, translated by W.H.D. Rouse. Book One: How Achilles and Agamemnon Quarreled Over Briseis, and How Thetis Persuaded Zeus to Support Her Son. An angry man, there is my story. The bitter rancor of Achilles, prince of the house of Peleus, which brought 1,000 troubles upon the Achaean host. Many a strong soul it sent down to Hades, and left the heroes themselves a prey to dogs and carrion birds, while the will of God moved on to fulfillment. It began, first of all, with a quarrel between my lord King Agamemnon of Atreus' line and the prince Achilles. What god, then, made the feud between them? Apollo, son of Leto and Zeus. The king had offended him, so he sent a dire pestilence on the camp, and the people perished. Agamemnon had affronted his priest Chryses when the priest came to the Achaean fleet, bringing a rich treasure to ransom his daughter. He held in his hand a golden staff, twined about with the sacred wreaths of Apollo Shutaphar, and made his petition to the Achaean people in general, but chiefly to the two royal princes of Atreus' line. My lords, and you, their subjects, for you I pray that the gods who dwell in Olympus may grant you to sack Priam's city and to have a happy return home. But my dear daughter, set her free, I beseech you, and accept this ransom, and respect Apollo Shutaphar, the son of Zeus. Then all the people said good words and bade them respect the priest and accept the ransom. But my lord King Agamemnon was not well pleased. He told the priest to be off, and in harsh words, too. Don't let me find you here any more, you. Don't stay now and don't come again, or else your staff and sacred wreaths may not protect you. The woman I will not release. She shall live to old age in our house far away in Argos, working the loom and lying in my bed. Begone now. Don't provoke me, or it will be the worse for you. The old man was afraid and did as he was told. Silent, he passed along the shore of the murmuring sea, and when he came home he prayed earnestly to Apollo, "Hear me, Silverbow, thou who dost bestride Chryse and holy Scylla, thou who art the mighty lord of Tenedos, O Sminthus, if I have ever built a temple to thy pleasure, if I have ever burnt for thee fat slices of bulls or of goats, bestow on me this boon. May the Danians pay for my tears under thy shafts." Phoebus Apollo heard his prayer. Down from Olympus he strode, angry at heart, carrying bow and quiver. The arrows rattled upon his shoulders as the angry god moved on, looking black as night. He sank upon his heel not far from the ships, and let fly a shaft. Terrible was the twang of the silver bow. First he attacked the mules and dogs. Then he shot his keen arrows at the men, and each hit the mark. Pyres of the dead began to burn up everywhere, and never ceased. 9 days the gods' arrows fell on the camp. On the 10th day, Achilles summoned all to a conference. The goddess Hera put this in his mind, for she was distressed to see the Danians dying. And when they were all gathered together, Achilles rose up and spoke. "My lord king," he said, "I think we shall seem just foiled adventurers when we get home, if, indeed, we get off with our lives. Now you see war and pestilence allied to beat us. Come, then, let us inquire of some prophet or priest, or even a diviner of dreams, for God, it seems, doth send our dreams, and let him tell us what has made Phoebus Apollo so angry. Does he find fault with us for prayer or for sacrifice? Does he desire the savor of sheep or goats without blemish, that he may spare us this pestilence?" He said his say and sat down. Then uprose Calchas Othestor, most excellent diviner of dreams, who knew what is and what will be and what has been in ancient days. He had guided the fleet to Ilios by the divination which Phoebus Apollo had taught him. He spoke to them from an honest heart, and said, "Prince Achilles, whom Zeus delights to honor, you bid me explain the wrath of Lord Apollo Shutaphar. Therefore I will speak. Mark what I say. and swear me an oath that you will defend me with all your might in word and deed. For I think I shall provoke a man who rules all our people, one whom all the people obey. A king, when angry, always can be stronger than a common man. Even if he smothers his anger for the day, yet indeed he keeps a grudge long in his heart until he can pay it off. Consider, then, if you will hold me safe. Achilles answered, Fear nothing, but speak the word of God which you know. For I swear by Apollo, whom Zeus delights to honor, to whom you pray, Calchas, when you declare God's word to the nation, no man, while I live and see the light, shall lay heavy hands on you in this fleet, none of all the nation, not even if you name Agamemnon, who now claims to be first and best of us all. Then the seer took courage and spoke out. He finds no fault with us, then, for prayer or sacrifice, but for his priest, whom Agamemnon affronted, when he would not accept the ransom and set his daughter free. For his sake, Shutaphar has sent us trouble and will send, nor will he stay the noisome pestilence among our people until the king gives back to the father his lovely girl, unbought, unransomed, and sends a solemn sacrifice to Chryse. Then we may trust that the god will be appeased. No sooner had he sat down than up rose my lord King Agamemnon in his majesty. He was displeased. The dark places in his heart were full of resentment. His eyes were like flashing fire, and he began by rating Calchas. Prophet of evil, you have never had a decent word for me. It is always your delight to prophesy evil, but good you have never said and never done, and now you get up and harangue the people with your oracles. So that is the reason why Shutaphar sends trouble, because of that girl Chryseis, because I would not accept the ransom. But I want to keep her myself and take her home. Why, I like her better than my own wife, Clytemnestra. She is just as good in face or figure, brains or fingers. Never mind. I will give her back, if that is better. I would rather have the people alive than dead. Only get a prize ready for me at once, or else I shall be the only man in the army without a prize. That is not right. Just look here, all of you, my prize is going away somewhere else. Then Achilles answered, Your Majesty, gettings are keepings with you, there's no doubt about that. Pray, how will our brave men give you a prize? I do not know of any common store anywhere. What we got from the towns we have taken has been divided, and you cannot expect people to collect it all again in a heap. For the present, then, give the girl up to the god, and we will pay you threefold or fourfold if Zeus ever allows us to sack the proud city of Troy. King Agamemnon answered, None of that. You may be a great man, Achilles, you may be more than a man, but do not try cheating. You will neither cajole me nor persuade me. Do you want to keep your own prize, and tell me to give up mine and just sit forlorn without any? If our brave men will give me a prize and satisfy me that I get as much as I give, well and good. But if they will not give, then I will take. I'll come to you, or to Aeus, for a prize, or Odysseus, and away I'll go with my gettings. Then it will be his turn to be angry. But we will see about that later. For the time being, let us launch a good ship and find a special crew and put Chryseis on board. And let one of the princes from our council be in charge, Aeus, or Idomeneus, or Prince Odysseus, or yourself, my young friend, you terror of the world. You shall pacify Shutaphar by making sacrifice. Achilles scowled at him and said, Ha! Greedy heart, shamelessness in royal dress. How could any man be willing to obey you, whether on some errand or in the battlefield? I cared nothing about the Trojans when I came here to fight. They had done nothing to me, never lifted my cattle or horses either, never destroyed my fruit or my harvest in Phthia. Too many hills and forests between us, and roaring seas. Now it was you I came for, shameless man, to give you pleasure, to revenge Menelaus, and you too, dog-face, for the Trojans' wrong. You don't trouble about that, you care nothing for that. And now you threaten to rob me of my prize, which I worked hard to get, which the army gave me. I never get a prize equal to yours if our men capture some town, but most of the hard fighting is done by my hands. Only when sharing time comes, you get most of the good things, and I have a scrap to comfort me. Not much, but all I can get, as I come back tired out with fighting. Now I will just go home to Thaya, since it is much better to take ship and go, and I don't think I shall fill my hold with riches if I stay here despised." King Agamemnon answered, "Do go, if that's what you want, go, by all means. I do not sink on my knees and beg you to stay for my sake. I have others in plenty who will honor me, first and foremost Zeus, all-wise. I hate you more than any prince on earth, for you are always quarreling and fighting. If you are such a mighty man, God gave you that, I suppose. Go home with your ships and your men, and lord it over your myrmidons, but I care nothing for you. I don't mind if you are in a rage. Now I give you fair warning. Since Apollo robs me of Chryseis, I will send her home with my own ship and crew. But I will take your beautiful Briseis, and I will come for her myself to your quarters, for your prize, to show you how much stronger I am than you are. Then others will take care not to stand up to me and say they are as good as I am." This pierced Achilles to the heart, and he was of two minds, whether he should draw a sword from thigh to push through the crowd and strike down King Agamemnon, or whether he should calm his temper and keep himself in check. As these thoughts went through his mind and he began to draw the great sword from the sheath, Athena came down from heaven. Queen Hera sent her, loving and anxious at once. She stood behind him and held him back by his long red hair. No other man saw her but Achilles alone. Achilles turned round, startled. At once he knew Pallas Athenea. His eyes flashed wildly, and he spoke words that winged like arrows to the mark. "Why have you come again, daughter of Zeus invincible? To see the insult of my lord King Agamemnon? I'll tell you what, and I will do it too. His own high-handedness one day may be his death." Athena replied with her bright eyes glinting, "I came to check your passion, if you will listen. And I was sent from heaven by Queen Hera, loving and anxious at once. Come, come, drop the quarrel. Don't pull out that sword. Just give him a sound rating and tell him what to expect. For I declare to you that this is what will happen. A time will come when you shall have a magnificent offer, with three times as much offered to make up for this insult. Hold back now and do what I say." Achilles answered, "I must observe the bidding of you both, goddess, angry though I am indeed. It is better so. What the gods command you, do, then the gods will listen to you." So he stayed his heavy hand on the silver hilt, and drove back the sword into the sheath in obedience to Athena. And she returned to Olympus, where Zeus invincible dwells with the company of heaven. But Achilles was angry still. Once more he addressed the king in violent words. "You drunkard, with eyes like a bitch and heart like a fawn! You never arm yourself with your men for battle. You never go out on a raid with the fighting men. No pluck in you for that. You think that's certain death. It is much better, isn't it, to stay in camp and rob anyone who tells the truth to your face. The king feeds on his people, for they are a worthless lot. Or else, my lord, this would be your last outrage. But one thing I will tell you, and take my solemn oath. As truly as this staff will never grow again, never again will put forth leaves and twigs after it has been cut from the stump in the mountain forest, and the axe has scraped off leaves and bark, but now it is held in men's hands, men of judgment who guard the statutes of Zeus. Hear my solemn oath to you. So truly a time shall come when Achilles will be missed by the nation one and all. Then you shall not be able to help them for all your grief, while many are falling and dying before bloodthirsty Hector. Then you shall tear your temper to tatters that you would not respect the best man of all." As he spoke, Achilles dashed down on the ground the gold-studded staff and took his seat again, while King Agamemnon opposite fumed with rage. But Nestor rose. A famous orator, he was gracious in speech, whose voice ran off his tongue sweeter than honey. He had seen already in Pylos 2 generations of men grow up before him and pass away, and he was king still over the third. He now spoke with an honest heart, and said,
"For shame, sirs! Here is a great trouble for the Achaean land. How glad Priam would be, and Priam's sons, how all Troy would be in jubilation if they could only hear you two quarrelling. You, the leaders in wisdom and leaders in war. Now listen to me. You are both younger than I am. Nay, more, I have met even better men than you, and they never disregarded me. For never have I seen, and never shall I see, such men as Pirithous and the great ruler Dryas, Sinius and Exadius and the noble prince Polyphemus. I tell you, those were the mightiest men ever born upon earth, mightiest, I say, and fought against mightiest foes, the monsters of the mountains, whom they horribly destroyed. Yes, those men I knew well. I travelled all the way from distant Pylos to visit them at their own request, and I fought by their side as a volunteer. Those were men whom no mortal now living on earth could fight, and they heard my advice, and took it, too. Listen to me, then, you also, and take my advice, and you will find it better. You, sir, do not rob this man of the girl, although you are strong. Leave her alone, as the army gave her to him at first for his especial prize. And you, Achilles, do not provoke your king, force against force, for greater honor belongs to a sceptered king when Zeus has given him dignity. If you are a mighty man, if your mother is divine, yet he is above you, for his dominion is greater. Your grace, forget your bitterness. And I beseech Achilles to let his anger pass, for he is the strong tower of our nation against the horrors of war."
King Agamemnon answered, "Indeed, sir, all that you say is fair and right. But this man wishes to be above all, to rule everyone, to be king over everyone, to order everyone about. And there is someone who will not obey, I think. If the gods everlasting have set him up as a warrior, does it follow that they have set him on to call ugly names?" Achilles interposed and said, "Yes, for I should be called coward and outcast if I yield to you in everything you choose to say. Lay your commands on others. Don't order me about, for I do not think I shall obey you any more. I tell you one thing, and you will do well to remember it. I will never use my hands to fight for a girl, either with you or with anyone. Those who gave may take away, but you shall never carry off anything else of what I have against my will. Just try and see, that these also may know. Very soon there will be red blood on the spear point." They finished their bout of hard words and dismissed the assembly. Achilles, with Patroclus and his friends, returned to his quarters. Agamemnon launched a good ship and put on board 20 men with the sacrifice, and brought Chryseis. Odysseus took charge, and they set sail. Then Agamemnon ordered the people to purify themselves. They cast their peace offerings into the sea and slew bulls and goats on the shore to make full sacrifice to Apollo, and the savor went up to heaven through the wreathing smoke. While all this business was going on, Agamemnon did not forget his quarrel with Achilles and the threats he had made. He called his 2 trusty servants, the heralds Talthybius and Eurypates, and gave them his orders. "Go to the quarters of Prince Achilles, take Briseis by the hand, and bring her here. If he will not give her up, I will come with a larger party and take her myself, which will be more unpleasant for him." So he sent his envoys with strict orders. They did not like their errand, but they went along the shore to the place where the Myrmidons had their ships. They found Achilles sitting before his hut, and he was not pleased to see them. They, indeed, were both afraid and ashamed before the young prince. They only stood and said nothing to him and asked nothing. But he understood what they wanted and spoke. "Heralds, I greet you. For the envoy is held sacred by gods and men. Come here, I find no fault in you, but in Agamemnon, who has sent you for the girl Briseis. Here, Patroclus, my friend, bring out the girl and let them take her away. Let them both be witnesses before the blessed gods and mortal men and before this hard-hearted king, if ever the people shall need me to stand between them and dire destruction. Indeed, he is mad with fury and cannot look both before and behind, so that his army may live to fight before our camp. Patroclus heard him and brought out the beautiful Briseis and handed her over to the envoys. Then they returned to their ships, and the woman followed them unwillingly. But Achilles burst into tears and went apart from his friends. He threw himself down by the gray salt sea, and, gazing over the waters, stretched out his hands, calling loudly to his mother, "Oh, my mother! I was born to die young, it is true, but honor I was to have from Zeus Olympian, thunderer on high. And now he has not given me one little bit. Yes, my lord King Agamemnon has insulted me. He has taken my prize and keeps it. He has robbed me himself." His divine mother heard his sorrowful cry, as she sat in the depths of the sea beside her ancient father. Quickly she shot up like a mist out of the gray sea, and sat down beside her weeping son. She stroked him with her hand and said, "My child, why do you weep? What is your trouble? Tell me, don't hide it, then we shall both know." Achilles answered with a deep groan,
"You know. Why should I talk when you know everything?
We attacked Thebe, Aetion's famous city. We sacked the place and carried off everything. The spoil was divided, and they chose for Agamemnon a beautiful girl, Chryseis. Chryseis, the priest of Apollo Shutaphar, came to our camp with a heap of treasure to ransom his daughter. He carried a golden staff twined about with the sacred wreaths of Apollo Shutaphar, and made his prayer to the whole people, but especially to the two royal princes. All the people spoke good words and told them to respect the priest and accept the ransom. But my lord Agamemnon did not like it. He told him to be off, and rudely too. The old man went away very angry and prayed to Apollo. The god heard him, for he loved the man dearly. He shot us. The deadly shafts fell all over our camp. The people died in heaps. Our prophet knew what it meant and told us Shutaphar's mind. I stood up at once and advised them to pacify the god, but the king fell in a rage and threatened me. And now he has made good his threat. They are sending a ship to Chryse with offerings for the god, and the heralds have just gone from my hut and taken away the girl Briseis, whom the people had given to me. Do help your son, if you can. Go to Olympus, pray to Zeus, if you have ever pleased him and served him by word or deed. How often have I heard you boasting to father at home, telling how you saved Cronion Thundercloud from violence and ruin, all by yourself, when there was a conspiracy in heaven? The other Olympians wanted to tie him up, Hera and Poseidon and Pallas Athena, but you came and saved him from that, by summoning old Hundred Hand, whom the gods call Briareus, but all men call Aegean. He is stronger than his own father. Hundred Hand came in and sat down beside Zeus, triumphant. The blessed gods were frightened and did not tie him up. Remind him of that, mother. Fall down and clasp his knees. See if he will help the Trojans and drive the Achaeans back to their ships with slaughter. Let them enjoy their king. Let his gracious majesty King Agamemnon know his own delusion when he would not respect the best man of all." Then Thetis answered as the tears ran down her cheeks, "Oh, my poor child, why did I ever bring you up for such a dreadful fate? Why could you not have stayed behind? Why could you not have been spared tears and tribulation? Since your life is but a minute, no long day indeed. But now you have both a speedy doom and sorrow beyond all men. Indeed, it was a cruel fate you were born for. Very well, I will tell your story to Zeus, Thunderer. I will go myself to snowy Olympus and see if I can persuade him. Be sure now to stay beside your ships, and be as angry as you like, but keep clear of battle altogether. For Zeus went yesterday to the ocean stream on a visit to the pious Ethiopians for a feast, and all the other gods with him. But he will be back in 12 days, and then I will go at once to the brazen halls and make my prayer. I think I can persuade him." And there she left him, brooding over the loss of his beautiful Briseis, whom they had torn from him against his will. But Odysseus came safely to Chryse with his holy offerings. They entered the deep harbour and furled the sails and stowed them below. Quickly they lowered the mast into the crutch and rowed the ship to her moorings, where they dropped the anchor-stones and made fast the hawsers. Then they landed and carried out the offerings for Apollo Chutaphar. Chryseis landed also, and Odysseus led her to the altar and gave her into her father's arms with these words,
"Chryseis, my lord Agamemnon has sent me to bring your daughter back, with a holy offering for Phoebus on behalf of the Danians, that we may propitiate the Lord who has lately sent mourning and trouble upon the people."
He gave her into her father's arms, and he received his daughter with joy. The men quickly set the holy offerings around the altar, then washed their hands and took up the barley grains. Chryseis lifted up his hands and prayed aloud,
"Hear me, Silver Bow, thou who dost bestride Chryse and holy Scylla, thou who art the mighty lord of Tenedos, verily thou hast heard my prayer and done me honour and smitten hard the Achaean people. Grant me now again this boon. Even now save the Danians from this dire pestilence."
So he prayed, and Phoebus Apollo heard his prayer. And when they all had prayed and cast the barley grains, they first drew back the heads and killed and flayed, carved out the thigh slices and rolled them between pieces of fat, and laid more raw flesh upon them. Then the old priest burned them upon sticks of wood, and poured sparkling wine over while the young men held their five-pronged forks ready by his side. After the thigh pieces were burnt and the inner parts were divided, they chopped up the rest and ran splits through the meat, roasted all properly, and drew it off. This work done, they prepared their meal and enjoyed it, and no one lacked a fair share. When they had all had enough, the lads filled the bowls to the brim and served the wine to all after spilling the sacred drops. So all day long the young men of Achaea appeased the god with sweet music, singing the healer's chant, a hymn to the far worker, and his heart was glad to hear. When the sun set and darkness came, they lay down to rest beside their moorings. But as soon as dawn showed her rosy fingers through the mist, at once they rose and sailed for their own camp. Apollo Farworker sent them a following breeze. They lifted the mast and spread the white sails. The wind filled the great sail. The purple wave swished and poppled against the stem. The ship ran free on her way over the waters. At last they arrived at their camp and drew the ship ashore, high on the sands, and set up the long line of dog shores. Then all scattered among the huts and the ships. But Achilles brooded still over his anger and did not move from his vessels. He never went to the meeting place, never to the battlefield, but wore out his heart where he was, although he longed for war and battle. When the 12th day dawned, the gods returned to Olympus in a body led by Zeus. Thetis did not forget her son's request, but she came out of the sea, and early in the morning she climbed to Olympus in the highest heavens. She found all-seeing Cronides sitting apart from the rest on the topmost peak of craggy Olympus. There she knelt before him, and threw her left arm about his knees, catching his chin with the right hand as she made her prayer.
"O Father Zeus, if ever I have served you by word or deed, grant me this boon. Give honour to my son. He of all others is to die an early death, but now see how my lord Agamemnon has insulted him. He has taken his prize and keeps it. He has robbed my son himself. Satisfy my son, Zeus Olympian most wise. Let the Trojans prevail until the Achaean nation shall satisfy my son and magnify him with honour."
Zeus, cloud-gatherer, did not answer, but long sat silent. And Thetis, how she clasped his knees, how she clung fast to him, and cried out once more,
"Say yes now, and promise me faithfully,
or else say no, for you have nothing to fear. Show me that you care less for me than for any god in heaven."
Zeus answered in great vexation,
"Bother it all! You'll set me curry-worrying with Hera and make her scold me again. She is always at me, as it is, before them all, and says I help the Trojans to win. You just go away again now, and don't let Hera see. I will manage to do what you want. Look here, I will bow my head to you, that you may believe me. That is my sure and certain sign here among us. When I bow my head, my word can never be recalled, and never deceive, and never fail.
As he spoke, Cronion bowed his black brows. The lord's ambrosial locks swung forward from his immortal head, and high Olympus quaked. So they had their talk and parted. Thetis dived from radiant Olympus into the deep sea, and Zeus entered his own hall. All the gods rose up from their seats to receive their father. Not one of them dared to sit still, but all rose up to greet him. So he took his seat upon his throne. But Hera had seen. She knew there had been a confabulation, and a visit from Silverfoot Thetis, the daughter of the old man of the sea. She lost no time in scolding at Zeus Cronion.
"Who is it this time?" she began. "Who has been confabulating with you now, you deceiver? You always like to go behind my back and make secret plans and lay down the law. You never would tell me a word of your notions if you could help it."
The father of men and gods made answer,
"My dear Hera, do not expect to know everything I say. You must not expect as much as that, although you are my wife. Whatever is proper for you to hear, you shall be the first to hear before any in heaven or earth. But when I choose to consider things by myself, do not be inquisitive and ask questions about everything."
Queen Hera said at once, opening her fine eyes,
"Oh, you dreadful creature, what a thing to say! I inquisitive? I ask you questions? I never did such a thing in my life. I just leave you alone, and you decide whatever you choose. But I am dreadfully afraid this time. I can't put it out of my mind that you may be cajoled by Silverfoot Thetis, that daughter of the old man of the sea. Early this morning she was kneeling and clasping your knees. I suppose you bowed your head and promised faithfully to honor Achilles and kill crowds on the battlefield."
Zeus Cloud-Gatherer answered, "You are a strange creature, always supposing, always watching me. But you shall gain nothing by it. You will only make me dislike you more, and that will only be more unpleasant for you. If this is as you say, it must be my pleasure. Silence, please, and sit down, and do what I tell you. All the gods in Olympus will not help you if I come near and lay my heavy hands upon you."
This frightened the queen. She sat down in silence and took herself in hand. But the other gods were disturbed, and Hephaestus, the master craftsman, was the first to speak. He took his mother's side and said, "Bother it all, it is really too bad if you two quarrel like this about mortals and make a brawl among the gods. What's the pleasure in good fare with bad manners everywhere? My advice to my mother is this, and she knows it is good. Give way to dear Father Zeus, and don't let Father scold any more and spoil our breakfast. What if Olympian Flash Lightning choose to knock us out of our seats? He is much stronger than we are. Come now, speak him fair and gentle. Olympian will be kind in 1 minute." Then he jumped up and put a double cup in her hand, saying, "Be patient, mother dear, bear it patiently, although it hurts. I love you, and I don't want to see you beaten before my eyes. I shall not be able to help you then, however sorry I am, for Olympian is hard to tackle. Once before I tried to help you, and he caught me by the leg and threw me from the threshold of heaven. All day long I fell, and at sunset down I came in Lemnos, with very little breath left in my body. There I fell, and the Sintians looked after me." Queen Hera smiled at this, and smiling received the cup from her son's hand. Then he drew sweet nectar from the bowl and carried it to all the gods, moving round rightways. Laughter unquenchable rose among the blessed gods when they saw Hephaestus, butler, puffing about the hall. So they feasted all day until sunset, and there was no lack, plenty to eat and drink, a splendid harp with Apollo to play it, and the muses singing turn by turn in their lovely voices. But when the bright light of the sun sank down, they went each to his room for sleep, for the famous Cruikshank Hephaestus had built them each a chamber by his clever skill. And Zeus, Olympian flash-lightning, went to his own bed, where he used to sleep sound when slumber came upon him. Into that bed he climbed and slept, with Queen Hera by his side. Book 2. How a dream came with a message from Zeus, and how the Achaeans debated in their camp. The names and numbers of the two hosts. All others, both gods and men, slept the whole night long. But Zeus could not sleep, for he was pondering how he could destroy crowds of men on the battlefield and cover Achilles with glory. It seemed to be the best plan to send a bad dream to King Agamemnon, so he called one and spoke plainly and to the point.
"Away, bad dream! Go to the Achaean camp, enter the hut of King Agamemnon, and tell him exactly what I say. Bid him arm the Achaeans with all haste, for now he may take the city of Troy. The Olympians are no longer divided. Hera has now bent them all by her entreaties, and troubles hang over the Trojans."
Away went the dream. Quickly he flew to the camp, and made his way to King Agamemnon's hut, where he found the king deep in blissful sleep. The dream leaned over his head in the shape of Nestor Neleides, whom Agamemnon respected most of all the elders, and spoke in these words.
"You are asleep, O son of Atreus, the lord of many horses. No master mind ought to sleep the whole night long when his cares are so many and nations are in his charge. Now hear me quickly. I am a messenger from Zeus, who far away cares for you and pities you. He bids you arm the Achaeans with all haste, for now you may take the city of Troy. The Olympians are no longer divided, since Hera has bent them all by her prayers, and troubles hang over the Trojans from Zeus. Be sure to keep this in your memory, and forget not when honey-hearted sleep shall leave you."
Then the dream departed and left him there, believing what was destined not to be done. For he thought he would take Priam's town on that day, foolish man. And he knew not what Zeus meant to do, for Zeus was yet to bring more sorrow and groaning upon Trojans and Danaans both before the war should end. The king awoke with the divine voice echoing about him. He sat upright and slipped into his fine soft tunic and threw a wide cloak about him. Next he laced his boots and slung the silver-studded sword over his shoulders. Then he took up the scepter of his fathers, which had been handed down from generation to generation, and holding this, he made his way among the ships. By this time dawn had come to high Olympus, proclaiming to Zeus and the gods that it was light. And the king commanded his heralds to use their good lungs and summon the people to meeting. They cried their summons, and the people came quickly. But first the king held a council of the elders beside the ship of Nestor, and when these were gathered he proposed a clever plan.
"Listen, friends," he said. "A dream from heaven appeared to me last night. He was exactly like Nestor in looks and voice, and he stood by my head and said, 'You are asleep, son of Atreus, the lord of many horses. No master mind ought to sleep the whole night long when he has so many cares and nations are in his charge. Now hear me quickly. I am a messenger from Zeus, who far away cares for you and pities you. He bids you arm the Achaeans with all haste, for now you may take the city of Troy. The Olympians are no longer divided, since Hera has bent them all by her entreaties, and troubles hang over the Trojans from Zeus. Be sure to keep this in your memory.' This said, he flew away, and I awoke. Well then, see if we can get the men under arms. But first I will try their temper as usual. I will tell them to ship and go home. You must post yourselves here and there and urge them not to go."
Then King Nestor rose and said frankly, "My friends, my lords, and princes of our nation, if any other had told of this vision, we might think it false and take no notice. But now he has seen it who claims the highest place among us. Come, then, and see if we can get the men under arms."
He led the way out, and the princes followed, obedient. Meanwhile, the people came crowding on. They were like a great swarm of buzzing bees which come on and on out of a cave and hover in clusters over the flowers of spring. Here they fly and there they fly, no end to them. So the men swarmed out of their huts and ships over the deep sand and marched in throngs to the place of meeting. Among them, God's messenger Rumour blazed abroad and quickened their steps. The place was all confusion. The earth groaned under them as they sat down, and there was a great din. 9 ushers tried to keep order with loud shouts to stop their noise and make them listen to their princes. At last they were seated and arranged in rows, and the uproar ceased. Then King Agamemnon rose, holding the scepter which Hephaestus had made and given to Zeus Cronion, who gave it to Hermes, king's messenger. My lord Hermes gave it to Pelops, and Pelops to King Atreus. Then Atreus, dying, left it to Thyestes, and Thyestes left it to Agamemnon, the sign of his rule over the whole of Argos and many islands of the sea. On this scepter Agamemnon was leaning as he addressed the assembly.
"My friends, my Danian heroes, servants of Ares, Zeus Cronides has wholly deluded me, cruel god. First he bowed his head and promised that I should sack the walled castle of Ilion and return safe. But as it seems now, his will was to ruin and deceive. He bids me return inglorious to Argos after losing thousands of men. Such, I suppose, is the pleasure of Zeus, high and mighty, who has overturned many towering cities, and yet will overturn, for his power is greatest of all. What a disgrace for coming generations to hear! How this great host of Achaeans fought so long for nothing, and failed like this, no end to be seen yet, and against fewer men, too. For just consider, suppose we should make a truce, and both Achaeans and Trojans have a count. Pick out all the householders of the city, and sort ourselves in 10s, and each 10 choose 1 Trojan to pour our wine. Many 10s would be without a man to pour. So many more are we, I tell you, than the Trojans of the city. But they have allies from many other places, good soldiers who baffle me and keep me from taking the city as I want to do. 9 years gone, as you see. Thanks to Zeus, our ship's timbers are rotten, as you see, and rigging loose. Our wives and children, I suppose, are sitting at home and waiting for us. And here is the work we came to do undone like this. Well, I will tell you what we must do now. Let us go on board and sail home again, for Troy we shall never take."
These words excited the great multitude, who had not been present at the council. The assembly was stirred like the long billows of the Icarian Sea when a sudden squall from east or south has burst out of the clouds of heaven. Then, as a strong west wind stirs a deep cornfield, rustling the ears and bending them low, so all that gathered was stirred. With loud clamor they rushed towards their ships. The dust rose under their feet and hung over them in clouds. They shouted to one another to get hold of the ships and draw them down into the sea. They cleared out the running ways and knocked away the dog shores. Their noise went up to the heavens as the multitude pressed for home. And they would have gone, fate or no fate, if Hera had not observed it. She called Athena and said,
"Bless us all, Atritone. Look there, you daughter of Zeus Almighty. Is this to be the end? Are they to go like this, sailing over the sea for home, and leave the boast to Priam and his people? Leave their own Argive, Helen, after losing so many lives in this foreign land, to get her back? Go now to the camp. Speak to each man in your kindly way. Hold them back, and keep them from launching their ships."
Athena lost no time. She shot down from the peaks of Olympus and found Odysseus standing not far from the ships. But he did not lend a hand to launch them, because his heart was full of regret and sorrow. Athena came up to him and said, with her bright eyes glinting,
"Odysseus, Laertiades, can you do nothing now, my prince? Is this to be the end? Will they tumble aboard and go sailing home? Will they leave their boats to Priam and his people? Will they leave their own Argive Helen, after so many men have died in a foreign land, to get her back? Don't stand idle here. Go among your men, speak to each fellow in your kindly way, and keep them from launching the ships."
Odysseus knew the voice of the goddess. He threw off his cloak and ran. His marshal Eurybates, who had come with him from Ithaca, attended him. He found Agamemnon and received from him the scepter of his fathers, which had been handed down from generation to generation, and holding this he passed along. Whenever he met a prince or a man of note, he stayed by his side and tried to check him with kindly words.
"How is this, my dear sir? I would not think of threats as if you were a coward, but do sit down and make the others do the same. You do not know yet exactly what is in our king's mind. He is only trying them now. Soon he will come down on the fellows. Did we not all hear in council what he said? I should not be surprised if he flew in a temper and let them have it. A royal prince has a high temper. His honor is from Zeus, and Zeus always cares for him. If he found a man of the people shouting and making a noise, he would bring down the scepter across his back and say, 'What's this? Sit still and listen to your betters, you battle-shy skulker. Muscle or tongue, you count for nothing. We can't all be kings. Too many kings spoil a nation. One king's enough for me. And why? He gets the right from God on high.'
So he went about giving them all a lead, and the men were herded back from the ships and huts to their meeting place once more. With a murmuring noise like waves of the sea where the deep roars and the breakers thunder upon the shore. Now they sat orderly in long rows, but one man was blustering and railing still. This was Tersites, a man with an inexhaustible flood of words, always ready to talk, and no manners and no sense. Anything to annoy the princes, anything to raise a laugh. And he was the ugliest man ever seen before Ilion. He was bandy-legged and lame of one foot, a humpback with his two shoulders crushed together into his chest. On the top he had a sugar-loaf head with a few tufts of fluff. Achilles hated him heartily, and so did Odysseus, for he was always badgering them. But this time he chose Agamemnon to revile with his piercing outcry. All the men were horribly angry with him and thought him a disgrace. But he shouted aloud his insults against Agamemnon.
"Your Majesty, what's wrong now? What do you want now? Plenty of treasure in your quarters, plenty of women in your quarters, the best of them chosen by us to give you whenever we take a place. Or is it more gold you want, which some gentleman will bring you out of Ilius to ransom his son, when I caught him, or some other fellow did, and brought him in fast bound? Or do you want a young woman to love and keep for yourself? It is not the proper thing for the master to drive his men into trouble. You fellows are all softies, disgraces, a lot of women, not men at all. Let us make sail for home, and leave this man in the place to digest his gorge of prizes. Let him see whether we are any help to him or not. Look how he has insulted Achilles, a much better fellow than he is, took his prize and keeps her, robbed the man himself. But there's not an angry thought in Achilles. He is a gentle one, or else, Your Majesty, this would be your last outrage."
There was a fine ranting speech against Agamemnon, king of men. Odysseus was by the man's side in a moment and frowned as he mercilessly told him off.
"You are a great orator, Thersites, we know, ready to say anything, but hold your tongue now. You had better not defy princes in a minority of one. I declare, you are the vilest man of all those whom our royal captains brought to Ilios. Then you should be the last man to take a king's name in your mouth and pour out insults on him and think of going home. We do not yet know clearly how things will turn out, whether good or evil will go with our homeward voyage, and so you sit here and revile my lord King Agamemnon because the fighting men give him a handsome share of the spoil. A regular jeering speech.
Listen to me, and don't make any mistake about it. If I find you playing the fool again like this, may the head of Odysseus no longer sit on his shoulders, may I no longer be called the father of Telemachus, if I don't strip the clothes from your body, strip off the cloak and shirt that cover your nakedness, and send you off to the ships roaring with pain after a good sound drubbing. With this he brought down the scepter with a whack between the man's shoulders. He shrank down, and great tears fell from his eyes as a blood-red weal showed up across his back. He sat down, terrified, and wiped his eyes with a helpless look in great pain. Then all forgot their troubles and burst into merry laughter, and you might hear one say to another, "Ha! Odysseus has done us many a good turn, good lead in counsel, good lead in the field, but he never did us a better turn than this. Now he has stopped this damn word-slinger from his speechifying. I don't think he will pluck up courage to rail at kings again with his foul tongue." Such was the common talk when Odysseus rose, holding the royal staff, and by his side Athena, in the likeness of a herald, called for silence, that all might hear from front to back and understand what he said. Then Odysseus gave them some good advice.
"My lord king," he said, "these men, as you see, wish to make you the most contemptible of mankind, and they will not keep the promise which they made when they set out from Argos, that you should destroy Ilios before you returned. They are like so many little children, or widow women, weeping and wailing together that they want to go home. Indeed, there is hardship enough here to make one go home disgusted. If a man has to stay 1 month from his wife, he is impatient when his ship cannot get out for the winter storms and the raging sea. But here we have the 9th year at the turn, and still we stay. So I cannot find fault with the men if they are impatient. But all the same, it is disgraceful to stay long and then to return empty. Bear it, my friends. Stay a little while, and let us learn whether Calchas tells the truth or not. One thing we know well, and you are all witnesses, all whom fate has not carried away. Only the other day, when the Achaean fleet was gathering in Aulis, bringing terror for Priam and his people, we were sitting round a spring near a holy altar, and did solemn sacrifice to the immortals under a fine plane tree with clear water flowing from its roots. Then a great sign was seen, a serpent with dappled back, a frightful creature whom the Olympian himself had sent into the light, shot from under the altar and leapt upon the tree. In that tree were a sparrow's chicks, quite young, huddled under the leaves on the topmost branch. There were 8 chicks, that made 9 with the mother. Then the serpent swallowed the chicks, chirping piteously. The mother fluttered about, wailing for her young ones. He quivered round and caught her by the wing, screaming. As soon as he had swallowed the chicks and the mother, God made him disappear, as he had made him appear, turned him into stone. We all stood amazed at this miracle. When this strange portent had come into our sacrifice, Calchas at once told us the meaning. He said, "Why stand ye silent, men of Achaea? We have seen a great miracle of Zeus all-wise, late shown, late to be fulfilled, which will be told for ever and ever. As this serpent swallowed the sparrow and her chicks, 8 chicks, 9 with the mother, so for 9 years we shall make war there. But in the 10th, we shall take the great city." That is what he told us. And now all shall come to pass. Come now, men of Achaea, stand here one and all in this place until we take the strong fortress of Priam. The whole assembly cheered loudly at these words, and the echo of their cries resounded among the ships. They were well pleased with the speech of Odysseus, but Gerenian Nestor had something to say too. "Upon my word," said he, "you are like a lot of boys playing at debate. Much you care about real fighting. What will become of our compacts and our oaths? Into the fire with all the plans and schemes of men. Into the fire with our libations and our hand-claspings on which we put our trust. There is no use in fighting with words. We can do no good with words, however long we stay here.
You, my lord king, as before, lead your men with unshakable will to the battlefield, and let these cowards dwindle away the one or two with their independent parliaments. They will never do anything. What is their plan?
Don't wait, but back to Argos.
Don't wait for God Almighty to see whether his promise is a lie or not. For I tell you, the Lord did bow down his proud head on that day when Argos set sail in those ships laden with death and destruction for Troy. On that day, lightning flashed on the right hand and showed omens of good. Then let no man think now of flight. Now, before he has taken some Trojan's wife to bed, before he has avenged our struggles and groanings for Helen's sake, but if anyone is so horribly in love with flight, let him lay hands on his own ship, that he may perish and die before the rest of us. And you, my lord, it is yours to decide, but listen to good advice. My own advice is not to be thrown away. Sort out the men by tribes and clans, Agamemnon. Let clan support clan and tribe support tribe. If you make them do this, you will know at once which of your captains and which of your men is good or bad, for they will be fighting among their own people. You shall also know whether it is God's will that you fail to take the city, or the cowardice of the men and their folly in the field. Agamemnon answered, I declare, sir, once more you show yourself best in debate out of all the nation. Oh, Father Zeus, Athenea, Apollo, if I only had 10 such counselors in the nation! Soon that city of King Priam would bow her head, stormed and sacked by our hands. But trouble and sorrow is my lot. Zeus Cronides Almighty has thrown me into fruitless quarrels and bickerings. Here am I and Achilles fighting about a girl railing at each other, and I began it. If we can only make it up, there will be no delay. Not one moment. Troy will be done for. Now then, men, dismiss for your meal, and let us make ready for battle. Sharpen your spears, each man. Look to your shields. Give the horses a good feed. See that the chariots are all right. Let war be the word. This whole day is for hard fighting, for there shall be no truce, not one moment until night shall come and part the furious hosts. Sweat shall run over many a chest under the strap of his covering shield. Many a hand shall tire in grasping the spear. Sweat shall bathe the horse's flanks as he pulls the tight car. And if I see anyone shirking the fight and dallying beside the ships, he shall have no hope to escape the carrion dogs and vultures.
At this speech, a loud cheer arose from the multitude, like the roar of the waves against a headland on some rock-bound shore, when the south wind drives them against a cliff that has no peace from the waters in all the winds that blow. They rose and hurried, scattering among the ships. They lit their smoking fires and made their meal, and they offered sacrifice to the everlasting gods, each man to his own, praying to be spared death in the maul of war. My lord King Agamemnon sacrificed to awful Cronion a fat bull of 5 years. Then he summoned the elders and chief men, Nestor first and Lord Idomeneus, Aeus the Great and Aeus the Lesser, and Diomedes, and sixth, Odysseus, his counselor wise as Zeus himself. Menelaus, that stout champion, needed no summons, for he knew himself what his brother was about. These all stood round the bull and picked up the barley grains, while my lord Agamemnon uttered the prayer. Zeus, most gracious and most great, thunder-cloud throned in the heavens, let not the sun go down and the darkness come until I cast down headlong the citadel of Priam in flames, and burn his gates with blazing fire, and tear to rags the shirt upon Hector's breast. May many of his men fall about him prone in the dust and bite the earth. But Cronion would not yet grant his prayer. He accepted the sacrifice, but gave him toil and trouble yet more. When they had finished the prayer and cast the barley grains, they first drew up the head and cut the throat and flayed, then carved out the thigh slices and wrapped them between 2 layers of fat and laid raw meat upon them. These they burnt upon dry leafless billets and spitted the inner parts to roast over the fire.
After the pieces were burnt and the inner parts were eaten, they carved up the rest and broiled the slices upon the spits until all was properly cooked. Then they drew off the portions and laid their repast. They had their meal, and there was plenty for all. When they had finished, Nestor began,
"May it please your majesty. We have been here long enough. Let us not delay any longer the work which God puts into our hands. Make haste, let the criers assemble the men, and then we will all soon get on the battlefield together."
Agamemnon made no delay. He sent out the criers at once to sound the call for battle, and the army was soon assembled. He and his staff of princes were everywhere, arranging the men in their sections. With them went Athena, holding her goatskin tippet, precious, unfading, incorruptible. With 100 dangling tassels of solid gold, neatly braided, worth each 100 oxen. Through the host she passed, dazzling them with the vision, and filling each heart with courage to wage war implacable and unceasing. In a moment war became sweeter to them than to sail back safely to their own native land. As a ravening fire blazes over a vast forest on the mountains, and its light is seen afar, so while they marched, the sheen from their forest of bronze went up dazzling into high heaven. As flocks of wildfowl on the wing, geese or cranes or long-necked swans, fly this way and that way over the Asian meadows and about the stream of Caistrios, proud of the power of their wings, and they settle on and on, honking as they go until they fill the meadow with sound, so flocks of men poured out of their camp onwards over the Scamandrian plain, and the ground thundered terribly under the tramp of horses and of men. There they stood on the flowery meadow of Scamandros, in tens of thousands, as many as the leaves and flowers that bloom in the season of the year. Like swarms of quivering flies which flit about the herdsman's shippen in springtime when the milk drowns the pails, so many were the Achaeans on that plain facing the men of Troy and eager to tear them in pieces. And as goat-keepers easily sort out the solid flocks of goats when they are mixed together at pasture, so their leaders arrayed the men in this place and in that place ready for battle. Among them was my lord Agamemnon, eyes and head like thundering Zeus, his girdle like Ares, his breast like Poseidon. As one amid the herd stands out from the rest, the great bull high above the gathering cattle, so Zeus made the great king appear on that day, tall amid many, standing out from the other heroes. O ye muses who have your home in Olympus, you also are divine, you are present among us, and you know all things. But we hear only a rumor and know nothing at all. Tell me then, I pray, who were the leaders and lords of the Danians? For the common men I could never tell and never name, not if I had 10 tongues and 10 mouths, a voice that could not tire, lung of brass in my bosom. Unless the Olympian Muses, whose father is Zeus Almighty, should call to mind all those who came to Ilios. Well, I will name the captains of the fleet, and number all their ships. The Boeotians were led by Peneleos and Leotos, Arcesilaus and Prothoenor and Clonius. These came from Hyria and rocky Aulis, from Skenos and Scolus, from hilly Eteonus, from Thespia, Rhea, and widespread Mycalessos, from the districts round Harma, Ilysion and Erythrae, from Elion, Hylae, and Petion, Ocalea, and the well-built fortress of Medeon, from Copae and Eutresus, and Thisbe with its flocks of doves, from Coronea and grassy Heliartus, from Patea and Glysus, from the well-built fortress of Hippothebae, and from sacred Onchistus, the glorious grove of Poseidon, from grape-clustered Arne and Medea, from Nysa, the divine, and Anthedon, lying upon the coast. From these came 50 ships, and in each 120 Boeotian lads. There were those who dwelt in Asclepius, and Minyan or Cominos, led by Ascalaphus, and Iamenos, son of Ares. Their mother was Astyoche, a maiden of high rank. Their father was mighty Ares, who lay with her in secret.
She bore her sons in her upper chamber in the house of Actor Azides. 30 ships were their squadron. The Phocians were there, led by Scidius and Epistrophus, the sons of a proud man, Iphitus Nobilides. These came from Cyparissus and Rocky Python, Chrysa the Divine and Daulis and Panopeus. Others came from Anamoria and Hyampolis, or lived along the noble river Cephisus, or at Lilia, beside the noble springs of Cephisus. 40 black ships were in this command. Their captains kept their lines of battle close to the Boeotian left. The Locrians were led by the runner Aias, King Oileus's son, the lesser Aias, not so big as Telamonium, far smaller indeed. He was quite small and wore a linen corselet, but with spear he excelled all the Hellenes and Achaeans. These men came from Sinos and Opios and Caliarus, from Bisa and Scarphe and lovely Ogee, from Tarphe and Thronion beside the streams of Boagrius. Their captain had 40 black ships of the Locrians, who were settled opposite sacred Eubea. There were the Abantes, breathing fury, from Eubea, who held Colchis and Eretria, and grape-clustered Histiaea, Cerinthus by the sea and the steep castle of Dios, with those of Charistus and Styra, all led by Elephenor Chalcodontiades, a true sprig of Ares, chief of the proud Abantes. His men followed him, quick men with hair grown long behind, spearmen ready and eager to push their ashen pikes, tear the tunics off their enemies' breasts. He had 40 black ships with him. There were the men of Athens, that well-built citadel, the people of great heart Erechtheus. In ancient times he was born out of Mother Earth, and Athena, the daughter of Zeus, nursed him and set him up in Athens in her own rich temple. There the Athenian lads seek his favor with bulls and goats as the years roll on. These Athenians were led by Menestheus, Petios' son. No mortal man upon this earth was ever his equal in marshalling horses and spearmen. Nestor alone could challenge him, for he was the elder. He commanded 50 black ships. Aias from Salamis brought 12 ships, which he ranged beside the Athenian lines. There were the men from Argos and Tiryns with the massive walls, from Hermione and Asine, which hold the deep gulf, from Treason and Ephione and vine-clad Epidaurus, Achaean lads from Aegina and Masses. These were led by Diomedes, the stout champion, and Sthenelus, the son of famous Capaneus. Third with them was Euryalus, noble as a god, the son of Mecisteus Talaionides. But Diomedes was their commander-in-chief. They had 80 black ships in their squadron. There were the men from Messene, that well-built citadel, from rich Corinth and comely Cleone, from Ornae and Erythrea the beautiful, and Sicyon, where Adrastus was king at first, from Hipparesia and steep Gonoessa, from Pellene and Aegion, from all Aegialus and wide Helice. These were led by King Agamemnon Atrides, 100 ships. His men were the most and the best of all, and he was among them himself in bronze armor, proud and conspicuous, because he was the best, and his people the most. There were the men from Lacedaemon, with its wide valley and long ravines, from Pharis and Sparta and dove-haunted Messe, from Brycia and beautiful Ogee, from Amycle and Helos, the castle by the sea, from Laos, and from Italus. They were led by his brother, the stout champion Menelaus, 60 ships. They had their station apart. There he moved among them, confident in his own ardor, inspiring them for war. His dearest wish was to avenge his passion and groanings for Helen's sake. There were the men from Pylos and lovely Arene, and Thryon, the ford of Alpheus, and well-built Epe, from Cyparissus and Amphigenia, from Teleus and Hellas and Dorian, where the muses met Thracian Thamyris and made an end of his singing, on his way from the house of Eurytus at Aecalia, for he avowed with boasts that he would beat the very daughters of Zeus Almighty if they would sing for him. Then they were angry and maimed him, took away his inspired song, and made him forget his harping. These men were led by Geranian Nestor, who loved horses so well.
90 ships followed him. There were the men from Arcadia and Selene's lofty hill, beside the tomb of Epitus, where men fight hand to hand, from Phenios and Orchomenos, with all those flocks of sheep, from Rhipe and Stratia and windy Anispe, from Tegea and lovely Manetia, from Stymphalus and Parasia. These men were led by Prince Agapenor, Anseus' son, 60 ships. In each were embarked many Arcadian men, well acquainted with fighting. Their ships were the gift of my lord King Agamemnon himself, well built and fit to traverse the Purple Sea, for seafaring was not their business. There were the men from Buprasion and sunny Elis, all that stretch enclosed by Hermina and Myrsinos on the coast, by the Olenian Rock and Elysian. These had 4 captains, each with 10 swift ships and large crews of Epeans. 2 captains were Amphimachus and Thapios, both of Actor's line, sons of Ctyrtus and of Eurytus. 1 was the mighty Diores, Amarynzius' son. 4th was the noble Polyxenos, the son of my lord Agasthenes, Augeas' son. There were the men from Dulichion and the sacred Echini, 2 islands which lie opposite Elis across the sea. These were led by Meges Phylades, like a new god of war. Phyleus, his father, the famous horsemaster whom Zeus loved, had passed over to Dulichion when he quarreled with his father. Meges had 40 black ships. But Odysseus led the proud Cephallenians, who were settled in Ithaca, and Neriton with its quivering trees, in Crocylia and rugged Aegilips, at Zacynthus and in Samos, all about, and they held the mainland opposite these islands. These were all under Odysseus, a man wise with the wisdom of Zeus himself. 12 ships he had, all with vermilion cheeks. The Aetolians were led by Thoas, Andremus' son, those who came from Puron and Olenus and Pellene, from Calchas by the seashore and rocky Calydon. For the sons of proud Aeneas were no more, nor he himself, and red-headed Meleagrus was dead, whose lot had been to rule over the Aetolians. Thoas had 40 black ships. The Cretans were led by Idomeneus, the famous spearman. They came from Cnossos and Gortys, the walled city, from Lyctus and Miletus and chalk-white Lycastos, from Phaistos and Rhytion, flourishing cities both, and others from the 100 cities of Crete. These were led by Idomeneus, the spearman, and Meriones. 1 like death-dealing Enyalius in person. They had 80 black ships under them. Tlepolemus, a great handsome man and a son of Heracles, brought out of Rhodes 9 ships of sturdy Rhodians, who came from the 3 districts of Rhodes, Lindos, Ialissos, and chalk-white Chimaira. Their leader, Tlepolemus, was a famous spearman. His mother was Astyochia, whom Heracles brought out of Ephyra, from the river Selleis, after he sacked many cities of lusty young fighting men. But as soon as Tlepolemus grew up, he killed his father's uncle Licymnius, the sprig of Ares, who was then growing old. At once he built ships and gathered a great company, and took flight over the sea, for he had been threatened by the other son and the grandson of his puissant father. He suffered much on his travels, but came at last to Rhodes. There his people settled in 3 tribal divisions. They were dear to Zeus, the lord of both gods and men, and he poured out infinite wealth upon them. Nireus, again from Syme, brought 3 ships. Nireus, the son of radiant Aglaia and gracious Carapos. Nireus, the handsomest man of all the host before Troy, next to the admirable Achilles. But he was feeble, and few followed him. There were the men from Nisyrus and Crapathus and Kassos, from coast the city of Europolis and the Calydnian Islands. These again were led by Phidippus and Antiphos, 2 sons of King Thessalus, whose father was Heracles. They had a squadron of 30 ships. Now again there were those from Pelasgian Argos, from Alos and Alope and Trichus, from Phthia and Hellas, the land of lovely women. These were named Myrmidons and Hellenes and Achaeans. There were 50 ships of these led by Achilles. But these had no mind for the din of battle when there was no one to lead them to their place, for Prince Achilles lay idle beside the ships, angry for the loss of beautiful Briseis, whom he had chosen out of Lyrnessus after a hard fight. When he had destroyed Lyrnessus and the walls of Thebe, and cut down Mynes and Epistrophus, the two warlike sons of King Euenus Lepiades, that is why he lay idle in sorrow. But he was soon to rise up again. There were the men from Phylace, and flowery Pyrrhasus, the precinct of Demeter, from Aeton, mother of sheep, from Antron by the seashore, and Petilius in the grassy meadows. These again had been led by Protesilaus the warrior while he yet lived. But by that time he was deep in the black earth. His wife was left in Phylace, tearing her two cheeks for woe, with the house only half finished. He was killed by a Dardanian as he leapt ashore first of all the Achaeans. Yet the men were not